in this series of lectures considering church history. First of all, we're really only considering what you might call the first course or the first term of a church history class. That is from the beginning of the church to the time of Reformation. So we're generally talking about the time period of about AD 33 or so until about the year 1500. And in that period, we've divided it up into several different segments. We divide up into the apostolic church, that's about 33 to 100. Then the early church, about 100 to 312, that's the conversion of Constantine. Then this long period of time that I call the Christian Empire, 312 to 1500, which we've divided that very long period into two periods, an early period, 312 to 1000, and a later period, 1000 to 1500. So in this particular lecture, what we're going to consider is the later period of the Christian Empire, approximately the year 1000 to the year 1500, which of course brings us right before the Reformation. So some of what we're going to be talking about in this and some of the following lectures is really going to be pre-Reformation kind of stuff. But what we're going to talk about in this particular lecture is some important trends, events, and challenges of this later period of the Christian Empire, period, if you want to say that. I'm repeating myself, but let's just talk about these. I think I have eight different trends, events, or challenges to bring before you here in this lecture. And the first one of those trends, events, or challenges is the rise of what I would call the imperial papacy. We're talking about the office of the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, the head of what is called the Roman Catholic Church. And in the Middle Ages, especially in the late medieval period, popes asserted their authority over any sort of council and began more and more to simply do as they pleased. One example of this was Pope Pius II. He was between 58 and 1464 as his time as Pope. He issued a papal decree that forbade any kind of appeal to a papal decision. And he said that the Pope's decrees were absolutely final. The name of that papal decree was known as execrabilis, which means accursed. And it asserted the Pope's power as the vicar of Christ, who had the power to bind and loose both in heaven and on earth. The decree also said that anyone who appealed to a papal decision was cursed to hell and could not be helped except by the Pope himself, and that only could be found on his deathbed. So again, this very notable papal decree, I should say, execrabilis, again, its features were that there could be absolutely no appeal to a pope's decision, not from a bishop, not from a council, that all the pope's decisions were final, that the pope was to be regarded the vicar or the representative of Jesus Christ himself, and that the pope had power to bind and loose in both heaven and earth. In other words, they just plainly stated that the Pope has the power to determine who goes to heaven, who goes to hell. Now, these were not ideas that came up in the time of Pius II. These were ideas that had been in the Roman Catholic Church for many centuries, but they just get stated and made formal in papal decrees and formally presented in certain places in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. The career of Pius II was interesting as an example of what you might call the depravity of the popes of that day. Pius II was born in the year 1405. His birth name was Ennio Silvio Piccolomenni. He was born in Siena as one of 18 children to a family that was of poor but noble rank. He was educated and began working as an assistant to several bishops and cardinals. He was a man who had good political instincts. In other words, he had the ability to take sides with whoever was in power or rising to power, and that helped him to rise through the church bureaucracy. Eventually, he was appointed to the position of bishop, then a cardinal, and when he was 53, he was selected among the cardinals as pope. He became Pope Pius II again in the year 1458. Now, to be honest, his sexual immorality was well known. He fathered at least two children, and he had many mistresses, and he liked to brag about his ability to seduce women. He said that his sexual appetite was a very old vice, and he used to say, "I can't be wiser than Solomon or holier than David." That's how he excused his immorality. He even wrote erotic stories that were published that taught young men how to seduce women. He appointed a nephew of his as a cardinal when that nephew was only 23 years old. And later he appointed a family friend to that same office when the boy was only 17. He once excommunicated a man, and again, in Roman Catholic theology, that means that he sent the man to hell. He excommunicated a man for keeping his hat on in the Pope's presence. Now, one time on a visit to Siena, Pius II met a man named Rodrigo Borgia, who even Pius rebuked for his immorality. Borgia used to give immoral and licentious banquets where women were invited to attend without their husbands. Now, Borgia went on to become Pope Alexander VI, who lived immorally, but at the same time, he commissioned Michelangelo to sculpt the magnificent sculpture that's still in Rome to this day, the Pietà. And again, this is one of the strange contradictions, you might say, of this period. They were capable of tremendous art and creativity, but they were basically immoral, and the office of Pope and many of the religious offices were basically political and economic in nature. In the year 1458, Pius attempted to call another crusade, but he had trouble raising the money among the kings of Europe to finance the crusade. The Germans opposed his attempt to raise money to establish a crusade tax. And when they issued their opposition, they pointed out that Pius II had a past of very notorious sin. And so his response to that was that papal decree, which we've called another place a papal bull, execrabilis. In the year 1464, Pius II personally led a crusading army against the Turks. While on that military campaign, he was stricken with fever and he died while on the crusade. Now again, Pius II wasn't much of a spiritual leader, but he was a very cultured man and he was a good writer. As I said before, he wrote recognized works of poetry and history and fiction and gave great speeches. One series of his Latin poems was noted for its influence on 15th century English satire. I mean, this was an accomplished man of letters, but he just wasn't a spiritual leader in any regard. In the year 1462, Pius II gave an elaborate celebration to commemorate the coming to Rome of what was said to be the skull of the Apostle Andrew. When this relic came into Rome, presumably to the Vatican, Pius II fell to the ground before the skull, and he congratulated the skull for coming out of its grave to join the remains of its brother apostles. But make no mistake about it, Pius II asserted that he was the single monarch over all Christians. I mean, in their conception, over all the Christians in the world, East, West, inside the institutional church, outside the institutional church. The Pope claimed authority over all believers, that he was the single king over all Christians, and he said that he received this authority directly from Jesus, while all other Christians received whatever authority they had from Jesus through the Pope, through himself. He declared himself to be the prince of all bishops and the heir of the apostles. Pius II, some of his last words on his deathbed were, "Pray for me, for I am a sinner." And again, I don't think he meant that in a humble way, such as every believer can still be a sinner and a saint at the same time. I think it was in great recognition that he was far from God. But at the time, Pius II was recognized as one of the great popes. Let me put it to you this way. From the year 1450 to the year 1517, that's just before the Protestant Reformation, there were 10 popes, and most of them were extremely corrupt men, far more interested in wealth and political power than in anything spiritual. And they did almost nothing for the cause of Christianity. Nepotism was a great problem. You understand what nepotism is? That's the word we use to describe when you appoint sons, nephews, and other relatives to spiritual offices only because they're relatives and not because they are spiritual or godly or qualified in any way. The only reason they get the job is because they're a relative. Now, even the popes who were supposed to be celibate priests, of course, they freely had mistresses and wives, and their illegitimate offspring were acknowledged without a blush. It was also true among bishops and priests, of course, the tone being set for this by the Pope at the top. They often made a good place for their sons and nephews by appointing them as cardinals. Now, in the Roman Catholic structure, cardinals are second only to the Pope in their office. A church council tried to curb this practice by at least demanding that anyone must be at least 30 years of age before they could be appointed a cardinal. But the popes ignored this. Teenagers were routinely appointed as cardinals, and there were even some cases of 8-year-olds and 7-year-olds being appointed to this high office. Now, you might say, well, why would they make a mockery of such a high office of the church? The answer was basically money. The way that the Roman Catholic Church at that time was structured, it was something like what we sometimes call in the business and sales world, a multi-level scheme. You see, a cardinal was appointed over a certain territory, and he received a percentage of all the contributions. Now, essentially, church taxes. This was not just the free will gifts and offerings, but church taxes upon people. The cardinal received a percentage of everything that came into his region. And the value of the offices of a cardinal or a bishop meant that they were offices that were often bought and sold. Routinely, the office of bishop was simply sold to the highest bidder, and then it was used as a way of generating income from the office. That's how you would pay off the purchase price of the office of bishop or cardinal. This was the practice known as the annate. The annate was the first year's income of an appointed bishop. That was given to the Pope. And because the money had to be paid to the Pope first or up front, it was often borrowed by the new bishop. By the time of the Reformation, the first thing that the Pope did every morning was call his financial advisor and decide which church offices they would sell that day. Now, the Vatican became a place where entertainment and art ruled, and where popes and cardinals were very wealthy, very cultured patrons of the arts. They would even entertain prostitutes with banquets and immoral comedies, dramatic productions. Let me give you a final illustration to communicate to you what I think is the spirit of this imperial papacy of the later period of the Christian Empire period. So we're talking in general 1000 to the year 1500. We're especially talking about the years maybe 1300 to 1500 with when it became worse and worse with this imperial papacy. Just listen to the names of the three popes who did any amount of ruling before the Reformation. Their three names were Alexander VI, Julius II, and Leo X. Consider those names. Friends, those are not the names drawn from church history, from Christian history. Alexander and Julius. Alexander was a Greek king. Julius was a Roman emperor. Leo, again, these are all describing secular kings and emperors. That is whom these popes decided to reflect themselves with, associate themselves with. So the imperial papacy was a very significant trend, and I would regard it also as a challenge for the Christian world, especially the world of Europe, in the later part of the Christian Empire period. Here's a second great challenge that came upon the church. This was really in the 13th century, in the 1200s. What you have is the great Mongol invasion of the 13th century. In many quick surveys of church or European history, this is not given much attention, but it deserves at least a few moments. In 1242, the most fearsome army ever to invade Europe turned back to the east after easily conquering almost all of Eastern Europe. And on 1241, they set their sights on a drive all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. Now, what some people call the Dark Ages were almost pure light compared to what could have happened to Europe if the Mongols would have succeeded in extending their dominion to the Atlantic. In the year 1242, Mongol advance scouts probed as far as Vienna, which would be the next major city on their agenda. And at that time, the middle of the 13th century, there was very little to stop their advance. The Mongols were famous and fierce horse warriors from the central steppes of Asia. They had remarkable weapons for that day, special composite bows that were superior to anything that existed in Europe. They fought surprisingly like a modern army with modern tactics and strategies, but they did it in the medieval world, and so they far outclassed any of the armies that they faced. The only two armies that were capable of defeating them in Europe had been defeated by the Mongols in April of 1241. Those two battles happened within a day of each other, but they were very long distances apart. On April 9th, 1241, a very large army of Germans, Poles, and Templar and Teutonic Knights marched out of Liegnitz, that's in Germany today, to attack a slightly smaller force of Mongols on the very flat fields of northern Poland. Liegnitz is in that area. They were defeated very badly. The Mongols defeated them severely in that battle. Then the next day, hundreds of miles away, on April 10th, 1241, Bela, a Hungarian king of the city of Buda, he went out against the advancing Mongol army, and with very clever and bold tactics, the Mongol commander, Sabultai, he won the battle and killed almost the entire army of King Bela, who escaped, but he didn't stop running until he made it to an island in the Adriatic Sea. So for the rest of 1241, having won these decisive battles, one more northerly in the area that is today Poland, and one more south in the area that's today modern Hungary, they defeated their foes, and in the year 1241, the Mongol armies rested. They prepared to attack again, ready to push into a weak and fragmented Europe. No Christian army had stopped the Mongols to this point, or had even really slowed them down. It looked very, very bad for Western Europe. Now, on this campaign of 1241, Genghis Khan, the great Mongol leader, he was not on this campaign. But his amazing military and political leadership made the mark on his army, which had conquered much of China, and then they started going westward towards and into Europe. The method of the Mongols under the leadership of Genghis Khan were basically calculated and planned massacre, genocide, we would call it today. When a city resisted him and eventually fell, and they almost always fell, they did fall, he had all the inhabitants of the city slaughtered. In the year 1220, it is said that Genghis Khan and his armies killed 1.6 million people at a Central Asian city called Herat. When it was told his commander by the commander that some people had survived by hiding among the corpses, then at the very next battle at Nishapur, they commanded that the heads of every corpse be taken off the bodies. At Nishapur, it's said that 1.7 million were massacred. They attacked Russia, and again they destroyed cities and killed hundreds of thousands. Again, when the Mongols conquered a city, they destroyed it completely. They had no use or trust for city life, urban life. China's population declined more than 30% during the years of the Mongol conquest. The Mongols reduced the once thriving city of Kiev, again in modern-day Ukraine, to a city of about 100 people that lived in blackened, burned-out ruins. So when the Mongols came to a city, the inhabitants of that city were given the opportunity to surrender. If they did, they were allowed to leave the city while the city was plundered and destroyed. And even then, many of the children, young men, and women were taken as slaves. Those who remained would be scattered into the countryside, again, because the Mongols hated cities. And as the Mongol armies approached Vienna, again, now we're in the year 1242, there was very little reason to believe that they could be stopped by any European power. It was just assumed that they would destroy everything in their path as they had done before, as they spread out over Western Europe all the way to the Atlantic. If they succeeded in that, they would have an empire that stretched over two continents, Europe and Asia, an empire then all the way from the Pacific coast of China to the Atlantic coast of Europe. It would have been a massive empire. Well, look, what stopped this? What changed this? If there was no European army that could stop the Mongol invasion as they were there ready to invade Vienna and then continue to move west as an unstoppable force, then what did stop the Mongol armies? Well, you could say that the death of a single man saved Europe from this disaster. Now, of course, in the big picture, we see the hand of God in all of this. But the man who died was Ogedai Khan. He was the leader of the Mongols and the third son of Genghis Khan, who had kept his father's empire alive and even expanded it. When the Khan, or the leader, died, their law required that the leaders go back to their homeland and elect a new Khan. Therefore, the Mongol armies retreated from Europe, and even when Vienna was in their sights and the rest of Europe lay virtually bare before them, they went back to elect a new Khan, and whatever the circumstances were, they never came back to invade Europe in the same way again. But you can imagine what an incredible threat this was. And you could say you see the providence of God in stopping this army of the Mongols when nothing else could stop them. Okay, that's the second of what we're going to consider. Next, I want to consider the plague and the Black Death, which are really the same thing. It's just two different words for the same thing. Bubonic plague came and first struck Europe in the year 1347. And for centuries after, the shadow of the plague darkened Europe. In the year 1347, the Black Death killed about one third of Europe. On maps, you can take a look and see how year by year it spread north and south throughout Europe, severely afflicting the population. It was, again, something that killed, again, it's a staggering thing to think of, up to one third of the European population. And it took some 200 years for Europe to recover from it economically and with the institutions of societies. Philip McNair in the Erdman's Handbook to the History of Christianity wrote this. He said, people lived in the shadow of this pestilence, and during the 15th century, Europe could be described as a death-oriented society. This really had a huge effect on the thinking and the mentality of Europe, starting in the 14th and into the 15th century. You could even say continuing on to the 16th century, the time of the Reformation. But this was a huge effect in Europe at that time. Again, a plague, the bubonic plague, the Black Death, that killed up to one third of the European population. Now, as a fourth trend, event, or challenge to face Europe during this second half of the Christian Empire period, you have the Turkish threat, the Turkish Muslim threat to Europe. You know, in the Muslim world, you have rising and falling empires and national groups just like anywhere. By the 15th century, we're talking about the late 14th century, 1354 or the mid 14th century, and continued on into the 15th century, you have the Turkish Ottomans rising up to prominence in the Islamic world. And in the late 15th century, under Sultan Muhammad, there were spectacular territorial gains, and the Muslims actually even invaded Italy. You know, they say sometimes Italy is shaped like a boot. Well, this would have been at the heel of the boot, or Otranto. They invaded Italy, and they attacked coastal cities south of Rome. Those might at any time be beset by Turks who would sack the cities and carry off both riches and prisoners to be sold as slaves. So the bottom line is this, is during this period in the 15th century, we're talking a couple hundred years after the time of the Mongols, once again, Europe lived with the constant threat that Muslim armies might come from the east and take more and more of European territory. This was a great concern for Christianity in Europe during this time. another important trend during this later period of the Christian Empire was the Renaissance and the revival of learning. Beginning in the early 1300s, there was an increasing interest in the Latin and Greek classics. This developed in the reviving of literature known as the Renaissance. Renaissance means new birth, or kind of symbolically, new learning. The restoration and the publication of the text of the Greek New Testament also flowed out of this, and it had very powerful results, more powerful than any of the publication of any of the other Greek literature that was recovered at the time. You see, classical works in both Latin and Greek had been lost to the thinking and the mindset of Europe for many centuries. Now they were discovering them all over again. Now, the scriptures would be copied, of course, and they did the very best that they could, but when Constantinople was captured by the Turks in the year 1453, then educated Greeks went to the West as refugees. They carried with them the priceless manuscripts that had been hand-copied by monks from centuries before. And so these were manuscripts of Greek literature that were forgotten in the darkened West. Soon, Greek professors were teaching in the universities of Italy the language which sort of opened up the key to these treasures of knowledge. And then from Italy to Oxford, the study of Greek, and associated with that biblical Greek, the classical Greek and biblical Greek, it spread very rapidly across Europe. So the Renaissance and revival of learning was a very important trend, sort of paving a way for the Reformation that would follow. And here, this is number six on our list of eight events, trends, and challenges. This is another one that's directly tied to the emergence of the Reformation later, and that is the invention of the printing press and the media revolution that followed from that. Again, during these same centuries, the invention of the printing press provided a way to get this new knowledge out. And it was printing the Bible that the printing presses were primarily occupied. That's what was printed first, which is kind of a nice thought, isn't it? Now, Gutenberg developed movable metal type in the 1440s at Mainz. In the 1456, Gutenberg printed 200 copies of the Latin Bible. That was the first Bible produced by a printing press. Now, the technique that Gutenberg used, movable type, it remained a very closely guarded secret in Mainz until about the year 1462. So for about 6 years, they were able to keep sort of a monopoly. Only Gutenberg knew how to do this. But in 1462, the city was plundered and the printers were dispersed. Within 20 years, the invention of the printing press and movable type had spread everywhere across Europe. By the time Martin Luther was born in the year 1483, printing was well established throughout all of Europe. Every large European city had printing presses. And within 50 years of Gutenberg's first printing of the Bible, printers had outproduced the works of many centuries of monks who would hand copy the scriptures or other works. Again, the chief book that was printed was the Bible. And this spread Christian teaching. As more books and Bibles were printed, more people became readers. And readers wanted more books. And this spread literacy quickly across Europe. But even for the illiterate, the Bible became accessible Because even if you couldn't read, hopefully your pastor could, and now he had a Bible that he could preach from, a Bible that he could educate his congregation from. Christianity, which we would very much call a religion of a book, the Bible, Christianity was becoming universal in a new way. Your Christian learning and faith did not have to end now at the church door. Because of the invention of printing, and of course it would take many, many years until Bibles became widespread across Europe, but now people could have Bibles for themselves. This is related to number 7 on my list of things that were important trends, events, or challenges. And that would be number 7, the spread of biblical knowledge. You see, the study of the New Testament across all of Europe showed the great contrast between Jesus and the corrupt Christendom on the other side. By the end of the 15th century, there were 98 complete editions of the Latin Bible had been printed, and much larger numbers of Bible portions. The Archbishop of Mainz renewed the edicts forbidding the use of German Bibles, but in about 12 years, there were 14 editions of different German Bibles that had been printed, 4 editions of Dutch Bibles, and there were many, many Bible portions in other languages spread about. You see, people wanted to learn the Bible, and this revival of Bible learning, Bible schools, the Bible used in seminaries, the Bible used in church life, this was a big revolution. There was a group known as the Brethren of the Common Life. They were basically a non-monastic revival movement that stressed the individual's personal commitment to God and their own life experience of the Lord. They successfully established a network of schools throughout the Netherlands and in northwest Germany in the 15th and early 16th century. And the schools were started by a man named Gerhard Groote. He was a Dutchman who expressed the principles of teaching when he wrote this, quote, he said, "The root and study and the mirror of life must be in the first instance the gospel of Christ." Gerhard Groote said that learning without godliness could be more of a curse than a blessing. The education was excellent, and notable students were men such as Thomas A. Kempis, who afterwards wrote a famous work called The Imitation of Christ. Another student of these Brethren of the Common Life schools was Erasmus. That was a great Greek scholar who wrote an edition of the New Testament that was very influential. Latin and some Greek were taught there, and children learned how to sing Latin songs about the gospel. Adult classes were also carried on in a way in which the Gospels were read in the local language. Now I just want to come to the final point here, number 8 on my list of notable events, trends, and challenges of this general period, 1000 to 1500. I can't leave this without giving number 8, the discovery of the New World. The European discovery of America by Christopher Columbus in the year 1492, and the discovery of the solar system by Copernicus in 1514. Both of those gave great enlargement to men's minds and activities. It was really harder to believe in a small, closed world where everything was tightly controlled. And so it was a very interesting time with new ideas, new thoughts, new challenges coming in to the European world, which was, in a sense, the most dominant Christian world at the time, Eastern Christianity was certainly alive and existing, no doubt about that, but it was very much under the boot of Islam at the time. It was in the West that Christianity had more influence. So let me just review, listing off quickly this list of eight important events or trends or challenges of this period. Number one, we have the imperial papacy. Number two, we have the Mongol invasions of the 13th century. We have the plague and the Black Death. We have the Turkish Muslim threat to Europe in the 15th century. We have the Renaissance and the revival of learning. We have, number six, the invention of the printing press and the media revolution that followed. We have the spread of biblical knowledge across Europe. And then finally, we have the discovery of the New World. In many ways, each of these things had an important role, not only in the history of its time, but in setting the stage for the Reformation that would follow. So please, you could join us for today's lecture. Hope you can join us for our subsequent lectures as we continue on in our study of church history from about the founding of the church on the day of Pentecost in the book of Acts to about the year 1500, the pre-Reformation period. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you can come back and join us for future lectures.